This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Everything you're about to hear is for education and entertainment purposes only. Whilst we are licensed, we're not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Any advice is general advice. Equity Mates operates under Australian Financial Services Licence 540697.
Equity Mates!
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is useful.
Welcome back to Equity Mates Investing, a podcast where we explore what's possible in the world of investing. If you've just joined us, a huge welcome. My name is Bryce, and today we're back with another Ask an Advisor with none other than Glenn Hare. To chat through it, as always, is my equity buddy, Ren. How are you?
I'm very good, Bryce. Very excited for this episode. We love doing these Ask an Advisor episodes. We know that accessing financial advice is difficult for a lot of people. This is our way of trying to make that a little bit easier. Send us your questions and we will put them to some of Australia's best financial advisors.
That's right. And as I said, we are lucky enough to be joined by Glenn Hare, returning to the studio off the back of a very successful episode last year, one of the most engaged, most downloaded Ask an Advisors of 2023. So he's back again for 2024 and we have so many questions to cover.
But that's not all.
No.
Not because he was the most downloaded episode of 2023, but it didn't hurt. But we've asked Glenn to join us for our first live event of 2024. Yeah. We're taking this Ask an Advisor concept and we're taking it on the road. It's been great to get your questions and ask advisors. We think it will be even better to cut us out as the middlemen and let you ask the advisors directly.
It's going to be such an easy night for us.
And so that's what we'll be doing on the 10th of April at the Chevelle Cinema in Sydney. If you're free and you want and you have a question that you want asked, come and join us. It'll be a great night. It'll be a lot of fun. We're all going to learn a lot. And Glenn's going to be exhausted by the end of it because he'll be doing all the talking.
That's it. Glenn specializes in providing advice for accumulators, or in other words, those that are in that stage of life of trying to build wealth. So, you know, 25 through 45 or whatever that period may be, Glenn and his team specialize in that. So super relevant. You'll find through this conversation today that he brings a lot of case studies and real life examples of the work that he's doing as well. So yeah, can't wait. It's going to be awesome. Equitymates.com/events. Grab your ticket. They are selling fast. It's only a matter of days away.
All right. Well, with that said, let's get to our conversation with Glenn Hare, the co-founder of Fox & Hare.
Glenn, welcome back to Equity Mates.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Glenn, today we have a number of questions that have come in from the community, and we've bucketed them in terms of some of the big challenges that you often hear coming through from all of your clients when they come and see you. Mm. Can you just, I guess, give us a bit of insight on what those challenges are?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the three broad themes, the first is I want financial freedom and how do we get there? The second is, you know, I'm on the property ladder and I want to understand how do I kind of upgrade from an apartment to a house, or even taking a step back from that, how do I get on the property ladder when property is so expensive across all major cities around Australia? And the third is really to do with that investment piece. One, I want to start, but I don't know where to start, or I've started, am I doing the right thing?
Well, all three of those buckets resonate, so I'm excited to get into this. Let's start with the financial freedom bucket, the ultimate goal for everyone, I guess. We got this question. So they want to be financially free by 50 and currently in their late 20s, so they do have a bit of time. Can you discuss some strategies for creating multiple income streams and building passive income to reach this goal?
Yeah, great question, and one that definitely comes up a lot. And just reflecting on our member base, like 80% of our members would be in their 20s, 30s. So that sense of financial freedom is one that they acknowledge is maybe not going to happen in the short term. But what I love about this question is they've given themselves some time to really drive towards that. So they've given themselves a good, 20, 25 years to drive towards that. And for someone in your 20s, someone in your 30s, the sooner you start on that journey to financial freedom, the greater the chance that you're going to have of actually getting there. In terms of building multiple income streams, building a passive income, generating an investment income, before we actually address that particular point, it's really important that we think about what financial freedom actually means for you. And the reason I say that is because financial freedom is a very broad term. Does that mean having no debt, so paying off the home loan? Does that mean working less? Does that mean potentially working the same amount but earning less in more purpose-driven work? So financial freedom is really, really different. So before embarking on any investment journey, it's important we have a good understanding in terms of what it is we're actually driving towards. And I'd argue that the passive income or the multiple income streams is just an enabler to give us that sense of freedom. But if we don't know what it is we're actually driving towards, it's going to be very hard to gauge whether we're on or off track. Some ways that I've seen, certainly have seen a number of our members drive towards financial freedom and areas that we've assisted them with. The first is turning skills into a side hustle. So for those that, potentially writers, content creators, photographers, et cetera, they might have the day job, but go out there, earn a little bit of extra cash on the side, through freelancing or consulting type work. And that can be a really powerful way to build wealth beyond the day job. And often it's work that people tend to typically enjoy more than the day job. Mm. Think about the sharing economy. So an example of that would be Airbnb or car share. If you're living in a city and you've got a car and you're not using it Monday to Friday, rent it out. Like there's plenty of platforms out there that will enable you to get additional passive income through when you're not even being inconvenienced by it. The Airbnb one is something that I personally use. So my partner and I, a number of years ago now, lived in Coogee. In the eastern suburbs of Sydney. We had a two-bedroom apartment and we rented out the spare bedroom. Did we want randoms living in our spare bedroom? Not really, but for $300 a night, I was willing to put up with it.
Yeah.
So, if you've got some space that you can rent out, $300 a night, renting out 2-3 nights a week, quite quickly adds up to tens of thousands of dollars over the course of the year. Mm. So, really thinking about how we can take advantage of the sharing economy, which we're all very, very familiar with, very, very comfortable with. And then there's, I was going to say the more traditional, but I guess another way to rephrase that is the areas that we specifically help our members with. And that's, building out a, really healthy stock portfolio so that we're seeing growth in those investments. We're also seeing dividends or distributions off the back of those portfolios. Acknowledging that with a stock portfolio, you might be thinking, oh, that sounds, really big and audacious. One of the biggest draw cards, certainly for me and working with our members to the stock market, is you can start small, right? Like if you're in your 20s and you're putting away a couple of $100 a week or a couple of $100 a month, the compounding impact driving towards that financial freedom in your 50s is going to be massive. And then the one that often comes to mind when people think about investment or passive income is property. So buying an investment property, paying down their mortgage and inevitably being able to utilize that rental income to potentially work less or do more purpose-aligned work. Mm. So which may come at a pay cut.
Now, reading this question and just thinking about this scenario, and it definitely resonates with me, late 20s, well, I'm now early 30s, but I was in my late 20s when I started investing, and thinking about financial freedom and building choice and all of those things, I think it's a very common scenario for people to feel, you know, they're just enough into their working life that they realize they don't want to do it forever.
Mm.
But they're also not at the point where life really happens. Kids happen, potentially school fees happen, you know, parents get sick, all of that stuff that sort of interrupts the best laid plans. So when you're talking to a client who's in their late 20s or early 30s and hasn't had all these sort of left and right turns and speed bumps, and they're talking about being financially free in their 50s, how do you get them to start thinking about, I guess, the resiliency of that plan and, you know, making sure that that plan accounts for, like, all the uncertainty of life in those coming decades?
With our members, it's around projections. So we're looking at current state of play before kids, potentially before wedding, before the, you know, the significant mortgage, before the potential for, you know, private school fees, things like that. If you're in your late 20s, early 30s, and some of those big kind of, I guess, life milestones, for want of a better word, haven't eventuated, then arguably you should be capitalizing on this opportunity, because your disposable income in the coming years is going to diminish potentially. So, you know, let's make hay while the sun shines, for want of a better word, and make sure that we're putting that disposable income, which may dry up for a period, you know, childcare is not cheap, etc., so that we're really focused on that long-term piece. And what I have found is putting, and literally had this conversation this morning with a young couple who have just had their first kid in the last 12 months, painting a picture in terms of what the next 10 to 20 years looks like, putting in all of those assumptions around family and property and things like that, and then looking at what does your picture look like in 50 years, all things being equal. This is what your portfolio would be worth. This is what your property would be worth. This is how much debt you'll have outstanding. This is what your super fund balance will be. And what was really interesting, what came out of that conversation was, so the mother, who is the primary caregiver in this particular scenario, her intent was to remain on part-time work, and she was looking at her super balance going, that's not as healthy as I thought it was going to be when I'm 50. For this couple, they were looking to sell their existing property and, you know, upgrade to, I guess, a family home, for want of a better word, which came with a significantly higher price tag. And they were looking at that scenario when they turned 50 and going, wow, that's still quite a bit of debt to still have outstanding at that age. They were then looking at their stock portfolio, and although they'd been quite diligent in their 20s, they acknowledged with childcare, with part-time work, they weren't going to have the disposable income to attribute to that, as well as pay down the mortgage. So they're like, we've been so diligent with that portfolio, and it looks like, you know, we're going to have to let it sit there and kind of do its own thing, reinvest the dividends, but we're not going to have the opportunity to make any additional funds to that. So what that enabled them to do is essentially go back to the drawing board and go, okay, we can do it, but that's not really what I thought. You know, they had this vision of financial freedom at 50. And when we ran the projections, they were like, that's not really my debt. They were like, this isn't really how I would define financial freedom.
Yeah.
And one of the key levers that we had, which was significant for this couple, was they were in a position where they wanted to travel every year, like a lot of our members do, which was great, and that was really important to them. One of the biggest levers that they had was just their weekly disposable income, like how much they're just spending on stuff. And a couple of hundred dollars per week, if we were able to reduce that by a couple of hundred dollars per week, they would go from still having about $1 million debt outstanding, at this was at age 55, to nothing, because they still had that 25-year runway. So it was really powerful for them to go, okay, so a couple of hundred bucks a week does have a huge impact on how we define financial freedom. And Ren, just probably taking one step back, you know, we're talking about people in their late 20s, early 30s. A lot of those in certainly the advice industry turn their backs on people in their early 20s. If you're in your early 20s and you're working full time and you're earning $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 a year and you're living at home, massive opportunity to make some really smart decisions.
Yeah, massive.
Love that. Well, that's a good segue for us to plug equitymates.com/advice if you would love to chat to Glenn and his team. I should preface, not just Glenn. He's obviously not just a one-man band. If you would love to speak to anyone at Fox and Hare, head to that web form and we'll be able to connect you. Before we move on, Glenn, you speak about projections, and with projections, you need to make assumptions about the costs of things. How much do you put against the cost of raising kids in a capital city?
How much does one kid in Sydney cost?
Yeah, 0 to 18. I don't know.
Millions. So a lot. Children are so cute, and they come to most of our meetings. There's usually a baby on the shoulder, but there is a significant cost. So how do we work through that? So the first is typically the household going down to one income. That's the biggest cost for most people when they think about starting a family. You've got, again, this is, you know, broad general comment, but you've got two people working full time, and then the primary caregiver typically takes 12 months off for work, just using kind of broad assumptions. The challenge with that is we then need to navigate 12 months of expenses and potentially increased expenses with the little one and only one household income. So it's really important when we're looking to start for a plan, we're looking to start planning for a family, we're really clear in terms of what our bills are going to be. So what are the non-negotiables? What are our likely kind of day-to-day expenses? And as a general comment, we usually look to factor in about, usually between $8,000 and $15,000 of baby costs. Whether that be anything from specialists, you know, doctors, to the latest bugaboo pram, to the car seat that goes in the back of the car. And it's really interesting. We talk about babies a lot with our members. And there's this concept of the first baby economy. So whenever our members, they have their first child, they're like, right, I need the best car seat. I need the best pram. I need the best, bag to carry the nappies. Second baby rolls around. They're like, oh, really not that. don't actually care.
I know a couple going through that right now.
I don't really care about any of this stuff. So just be conscious of that. And interestingly, one of our members, having just exactly actually the same members that I met with this morning, she's looking to start a side hustle and actually looking to start a business, almost like a marketplace for baby goods. So because they grow out of them so fast, and some of these things that are so relevant for the first year and not for the second, creating a marketplace to then be able to on-sell that. Kind of like Facebook Marketplace, I suppose, but just for baby goods.
Oh, nice.
Love it.
So that's her side hustle. But in terms of beyond the initial 12 months, it's then considering what life would look like post that 12 months. So be having a really good understanding in terms of what the parental leave policy is for both parents. Having an understanding in terms of when the primary caregiver does go back to work, is it part-time, is it full-time? Childcare, even with rebates, is really expensive. So understanding the trade-off between actually going to work and then paying childcare and what the implications of that are going to be. And what we see over the first 3, 4, 5 years of starting a family is cash flow is usually pretty tight as the household kind of settles down into the new norm. And then the little one, if going to public school, goes out of childcare to public school 5 days a week, and then we see the disposable income skyrocket back up again. And then there's a conversation to be had. What are we doing with the $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 every single year that we're pumping into childcare? What do we now do with that? And then high school comes along, and then we have a similar conversation around private school versus public. And you know, the costs are high, particularly around high school as well. Some of our members, we actually have investment strategies set up for them before they even conceive their first child. Wow. So if they're adamant that they want to send their kid to, you know, the private school that they went to, or they want at least the option to be able to do that, we're putting often into market-linked investment, so in the stock market, given, you know, if we're starting pre-baby to high school, we've got a good 10, 12-year runway. We're looking at those higher growth strategies to give us the best possible chance to pay the school fees when they eventuate, as opposed to getting to that point going, shit, this is a lot of money, and then just redrawing on the mortgage that we've just been so diligently paying down for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, far out.
Yeah. That's probably a good time to turn to investment and portfolio questions, because we got a few of them. And this first one I quite liked. So the question was, they say 30% of my salary is roughly what should be spent on housing. Generally speaking, what percentage of my income should I be aiming to save and invest per month?
Can I be a bit cheeky?
Please.
Why did you like this question?
Well, I think
it's one of those rule of thumbs.
Yeah, there's so much spoken about this 30% for housing, which, you know, living in Sydney, I think is just bull. Like, no one sticks to that. But we don't really speak about any of the other, I guess, percentage weightings in a model personal finance budget. And I know it's because it's a how long's a piece of string, and, you know, everyone gets paid different things, and what you save and invest is really a function of all the other buckets and how much you have to spend on necessities. But, you know, the 30% is a goal. Should there be a goal for this bucket as well?
I'm not into percentages. I think percentages are just super generic. Percentages are, you know, I guess, you know, to elaborate, percentages aren't a bad place to start. You know, it's a very broad, 30%, a third of your income, that, okay, that feels right. I don't really know why, but that feels okay. But I'm more interested in, well, what are we actually trying to achieve? So, and what I mean by that is, some of our members have aspirations to, you know, buy an apartment. If we're talking about Sydney or even Melbourne, you know, we're going to have to drop $800,000 on an apartment. And that may be home for a period, but then maybe they want to travel the world for the next 5 years. So, you know, it's more around understanding what is the goal? What is the objective? So if, you know, for some of our members, the goal is to have a family home in Sydney. And if they want to have 2-3 kids with land, like, the reality is they're going to have to put far more than 30% of their salary into this one investment. And if that's what they want to do and that's what's really important to them, then that's what they should do. But if we're looking at a different scenario and someone wants a greater degree of flexibility, they don't want to be, they want to have a home base, but they don't want it to be, you know, everything. They want to still be able to, you know, travel and, you know, maybe they'll rent it out for a period and move around, then arguably, you know, maybe that 30% is much more appropriate. So they've got more of their salary to do other things with. And that's not just spending on travel, as nice as that might be, but that may be putting it into more, I guess, liquid style investments, or more, you know, such as investing in the stock market, such as putting it in a, you know, a high interest savings account. So it's at call and there's that greater degree of flexibility. Because if I come back to that scenario and I think about, you know, the 20-year-old talking about, you know, the late 20s talking about financial freedom, they're probably not driving towards their forever home. Certainly if, again, we're looking at some of the major cities, it's going to be a stepping stone. And they probably want to do that because they want a degree of flexibility when going into that strategy. They don't want to put all of their eggs in one basket and then never be able to, you know, have a European summer again.
So, Glenn, the next question that's come through is around super. It says, if our super is falling behind the benchmark for where it should be for our age group, should we salary sacrifice until we make it back to that benchmark, after which point we'd stop salary sacrificing to focus on other debts like mortgage until we have spare cash we want to put voluntarily put into super again. This is also assuming investments we make outside of super is not specific for retirement.
Sorry, just before we get into the strategies there, Glenn, maybe if you can just comment on the concept of benchmarking super for a particular age group. Is that something that you believe in, and where do you find them as well? Yeah.
Interesting. I went to exact same, out of all of the words, it was quite a big question. Benchmark is the one that I stuck on because I was quite interested to probably understand what are they actually benchmarking against. And you're right, like for different age groups, it's going to mean different things to different people. But if we look at some of the numbers, and these are some really high-level numbers, but for someone to retire at 65 and give them what is classed as, I suppose, a comfortable retirement, they need about $600,000 in retirement savings. For someone, for a couple, it's probably about $700,000 for a comfortable retirement. And what do I mean by a comfortable retirement? So it's a modest retirement. So it's really, you know, an annual domestic trip. An annual domestic trip to kind of see family and friends. And this particular definition is one overseas trip every 7 years, right? So again, thinking about our member base, they're doing a lot more than one overseas trip every 7 years. And that's a huge goal, and it's really important to them. So, you know, if we're looking at our supers and we're not on track to hit 600 or 700, then by age 65, it's going to be, I guess, more modest than that. And this is also assuming you own your own home, right? So this is, we've bought a property, we've paid off the debt, and we're not paying rent. The other thing that stood out to me when you were talking through the question is, why is their super falling behind? So, you know, and there's a couple of reasons for that. So potentially lower income, you know, type work. Time overseas is a big one that I see certainly through our member base. If they're overseas for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, not contributing to super, that can have a fairly significant compounding impact. Time out of work for any reason, so being made redundant or time off to start a family is another one. The other is simply performance. Like, you know, what is your fund? How is your fund actually performing? And what fees are they charging you? We're going to go to the effort of salary sacrificing, like putting more money into super to try and catch up. It's really important that we understand what we're putting our money in and what we're investing in and what fees we're going to be charged when we put that additional money in. Like salary sacrificing, super, you know, super tax efficient. You know, I love the fact that, you know, this individual's thinking about that. But don't just put money in a fund blindly, even if it is, you know, whether you wouldn't do that if it was in your personal name. So don't do it if it's your super fund as well.
So to answer the question on the benchmarking piece, you know, it's a clickbait article that I reckon news.com do every 6 months.
Like, here's
how much super you should have at your age group. Yeah. I just Googled it and ABC's come up with one. And the way that they're presenting it is in line with what you've said around comfortable retirement. They're saying if you want to have a comfortable retirement and that $600,000 in your superannuation by the age of 60 or whatever, here are the sort of balances you need at every sort of 5 year hurdle. So it's saying 35, I'm almost approaching that age. I should have about 102,000 in my super to be on track. I guess from your point of view, Glenn, A, is it worth looking at these numbers? And B, if I have 60,000 in my super instead of 102,000, should I be freaking out and going, I'm not on track. I need to bulk this up as fast as possible going into my 35. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And so should you be looking at these numbers? Yes. But, you know, even, you know, in line with the 30% on property, think about what a comfortable retirement means to you. So if the target is $600,000 to have a comfortable retirement, which is defined by an annual domestic trip and an overseas trip every 7 years, and that's your definition, and your house is, and home is completely paid off, and that's your definition of a comfortable retirement, then that figure is going to mean a lot more than someone wants to do Europe every second year.
Yeah.
Yep. And the other thing is, should you be freaking out? No. If you're 35, you've got so much time on your side, but don't do what most people do and wait until they're 5 to 10 years from retirement.
Mm.
And then, and this is the super is the fundamental reason why most people seek financial advice in Australia. Like the average age of an advised client is 58. Because they get to 58 and then they freak out. And
good.
And you probably, you know, I'm not saying freak out, that's definitely not the intention, but the runway to that comfortable retirement is a lot shorter than when you're sitting here at 35. So be diligent about it. Don't freak out, but think about, okay, well, how can we make some small incremental changes in our life today to give us a greater chance of achieving what we believe is comfortable. But again, I circle back to my comment, don't just salary sacrifice blindly because an article told you it can be really tax effective and save you lots of money in tax. It can be tax effective. I'm not saying it can't. It's a very tax effective strategy. But it's your, when you're putting that money in, you're still investing it. So understand what you're investing in.
Mm. Well, Glenn, I think that's a good point to remind people that if they want to speak to you or your team and get some professional advice, they should go to equitymates.com/advice, fill out the form, and we can put you in touch with a team at Fox & Hare. We're going to take a quick break here, and then on the other side, we've got a number of questions. We've got to hit property. It's, you know, you can't do an episode of a finance podcast without hitting property. We're also going to hit travel and how you help your clients fulfill some of their travel desires while also building for their financial future. So we'll be back in a second.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction. And free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome back to Equity Mates. We're speaking with Glenn Hare. Glenn, we've covered a lot so far. We've always got more questions than we have time to cover. So I want to move to one on travel and how we can still sort of build for our financial future. So we got one question. All of my friends are going to London for 2 to 3 years. I want to do the same, but I also want to own a home in Australia. Can you discuss strategies for balancing these aspirations financially?
Great question. And actually, I was having a chat to a journo at the AFR a couple of weeks ago about this specific scenario. So in short, you can do both, but you've got to have a plan. So what I mean by that is what I have observed is people go over to London or the States or Hong Kong or whatever it may be. They do 2-3 years overseas. They come back and they're in the same financial position they were when they left. So they're leaving in their late 20s, coming back in their early 30s, like, okay, I'm still where I was. When you're overseas, what's really important is have a really good time. Like you're in, you know, if you're in London, you're the gateway to Europe. Get it out of your system. I'm sure I've actually all got it completely out of my system. But anyway, that's another conversation. You know, head to Ibiza, get to Mallorca, make sure you swing by Mykonos. But don't forget about when you come home, right? So if you're planning on the stay is 3 years time, and you want to come back and you want to buy your first home in Australia, and you reckon it's going to cost you about $1 million, and you think you're going to need, you know, $100,000 to $200,000, and I'm just using really broad numbers as a deposit, make sure when you're over there, you've got a strategy to send money back home so that when you come back, that deposit is there. So don't lose the discipline around that regular savings piece. And also sending money back on a regular basis has two kind of key impacts. First, it quarantines the money to some extent. So you're bringing it back, it's out of sight, it's out of mind, we're saving, you know, $2,000, $3,000, whatever it may be on a monthly basis to drive towards that goal. The second is from an FX perspective. So you're almost hedging your bets to some extent. So if you're over in London saving pound, and then in 3 years' time you bring back $100,000, you're transferring your £50,000 to $100,000, you're doing that in one fell swoop. Whereas if you're consistently bringing those funds back, it's that dollar cost averaging concept, really, but you're doing so when thinking about the foreign exchange implications. So it comes back to the goal. What do you envisage your life looking like when you come home? That can be really hard to think about when you're about to head over to London. But don't lose sight. Future you will thank you.
Yeah, love that. Even the smallest things you will thank yourself for. Now, Glenn, as Ren said, we can't get through an episode without touching on property. And there are a couple of questions around affordability and feeling stressed about not being able to get into the market as first home owners, particularly in capital cities. So what are some things that you generally need to put in place, you know, if you do have the goal of owning a home? And I guess, what are the financial considerations to think about when buying your first property, particularly in, you know, expensive capital cities?
Yeah. So property naturally comes up a lot in our conversations. I was super chuffed. One of our members I've been working with for probably about 2.5 years, she reached out to us with about $40,000 of bad debt, credit card, personal loans, things like that. And a couple of weeks ago, she settled on her first property,
nice.
two bedroom apartment in Bondi. So okay. no small feat. What she had was a plan, and she had a really clear goal, and we took away all of the noise. And I'm not in denial about the fact that buying property in any capital city, and we work with people all across Australia, is really bloody hard. It's really hard. But I don't want people to be, put off by all of the clickbait and the headlines that you see around, you can't do it. You can. We may need to taper expectations. It might not be the forever home, you know, right off the bat. It could be, it could be an investment property as a starting point to kind of build that momentum. It might be a small apartment, which in 5 years we then, you know, have aspirations to upgrade to it to a bigger property. You can do it. You just need to be really clear on what those goalposts look like, and then work backwards from that. So going into to this question and going, I want to buy my first property, the first thing I'd work through is, what does that look like? So is it an apartment? Is it a house? Is it an investment? Is it one you're living in? What is the rough guide around what you're looking to spend? And then get really clear on cash flow. So what I mean by that is, if you're looking to purchase, I'm just using, again, round numbers, $1 million property, and we want to work towards a 10% deposit, so we're comfortable that we might have to pay a little bit of lender's mortgage insurance, and I won't go down that rabbit hole, but we need 100 grand, then if we're putting away $2,000 every single month consistently, then in 4 years' time, we'll be buying that $1 million apartment. Okay, so be clear on what the goal is and then work backwards from that. If you're just saving whatever's left over at the end of each month in an account that's called the house deposit, which you often then dip into for 100%. New TV, yeah. European vacations, yeah. Things like that, then that's gonna put that goal back. if you quarantine that money, you put the $2,000 in and you leave that aside and you've got a separate account for that lifestyle, you know, bigger ticket item discretionary spend, that's going to give you that understanding in terms of when you're going to be there.
Yeah. I think I set up my house deposit fund savings account in my first week of uni. Way too ambitious.
Well, that's probably part of the challenge. It's like you set it up, but if you don't believe it's realistic, it's just like
that
whatever.
That was exactly what it was. Yeah. I was like, it was such a far-fetched dream that I was like, any money going in here, I know I'm going to need for something else.
Who knew? Like, it only took aspiration. It took you 15 years from you setting up that account to buying a house.
There you go. It is possible.
It's really, I see it time and time again. And again, I want to preface this. It's hard, right? Like there's going to be trade-offs. It might not be Europe every year. It might be Bali every second year. Do you know what I mean? But you can do it. So don't, you know, there's a lot of, you know, the media does really put out a lot of clickbait and make it, you know, really, I suppose, feel unachievable. But if you don't know what it is you're trying to achieve, then how do you know whether it's achievable or not?
Yeah, yeah. It's so funny you say that example. Last year, Harriet, my wife and I went to Europe for 5 weeks in July. Bought a house at the end of last year. This year we're going to Bali.
Not so bad though, right?
No, can't wait.
So must be nice.
I'm looking forward to it. True.
All right. Well, Very nice. Bryce explains how out of touch he is, Glenn, I think that's probably the point where we're going to have to leave it. But a massive thank you for joining us today and sharing your knowledge. As we've said throughout this interview, if people want to speak to Glenn or his team, head to equitymates.com/advice. And if you have any questions that you'd like to submit to any of our advisors, Glenn will be back on before you know it. Head to equitymates.com/contact and submit your questions there. But Glenn, a massive thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
You have been listening to an EquityMates Media production. In the spirit of reconciliation, EquityMates Media acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This podcast is intended for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general advice only and has not taken into account your personal financial circumstances, needs, or objectives. Before acting on general advice, you should consider if it is relevant to your needs and read the relevant product disclosure statement. And if you're unsure, please speak to a financial professional. The hosts of this podcast and their guests may have positions in the companies mentioned. EquityMates Media operates under an Australian Financial Services Licence 540697.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.